So said, so done. At the next quarter of the moon, it was not long before the new year and the great feast of Opet, on which day decisive events were to come to pass in Potiphar's house, Aene gave out invitations to that ladies' party in Petipre's house, which has been so widely, if not always so wisely, celebrated in song. It was a large afternoon affair, and took on added luster through the presence of Nesbamet, Beknekens's wife and first among the women of the harem. There was no lack of flowers or unguents, or of cool drinks, some of them intoxicating, some only refreshing, or of cakes of various sorts, crystallized fruits and spun sugar sweetmeats, handed by young maidservants in charmingly exiguous costumes, with black braids hanging in their necks and veils shrouding their cheeks, a novel refinement which was much applauded. A delightful orchestra of harpists, lute players, and flautists, in wide diaphanous garments revealing their embroidered girdles underneath, made music in the fountain court, where most of the ladies settled down informally, partly on chairs and stools among the laden tables, partly kneeling on gaily colored mats. They also occupied the columned hall, from which the image of Atum Re had been removed. Mut's friends were graceful and exquisite to behold. Their flowing hair was anointed with perfumed oil from the crowns of their heads to where it finished off in a twisted fringe, through which peeped the golden discs of their ear ornaments. Their limbs were a lovely brown. Their sparkling eyes reached to their temples. Their little noses bespoke nothing but pride and high spirits. The patterns of their jeweled and faience necklaces and arm rings, the spider-web linen that spanned their sweet bosoms and seemed woven of sunshine or moonbeams, were the very last word in elegance. They smelt of lotus flowers. They passed each other sweetmeats and chattered in high, twittering voices, or else in deeper, rougher ones, for in this climate women sometimes have such voices, for instance, Nesbamet. They talked of the approaching feast of Opet, of the great procession of the Holy Triad in their barks by water and land, of the reception of the god in the southern house of women, where they, the ladies, would dance and sing and shake their rattles in their character as sweet-voiced concubines of the god. The topic was both attractive and important, yet at this moment it only served to keep their tongues wagging and fill in the time until their hostess, Mut M. Ennet, should give them answer and let them know the thrilling cause of her exhaustion. She sat, a figure of suffering amongst them, beside the basin, smiling faintly with her tortured, sinuous mouth, and awaiting her moment. As in a dream, and after the pattern of a dream, she had made her arrangements to enlighten her friends, and she felt dreamlike certainty of their success. The moment arrived with the climax of the feast. Splendid fruits were standing ready in flower-trimmed baskets, fragrant golden spheres bursting with refreshing juice under their leathery skins. They were Indian blood oranges, a great rarity, and beside them lay charming little knives that had handles inlaid with blue stones and highly polished bronze blades to which the hostess had given special attention. She had had them sharpened, to a pitch of sharpness indeed, such as seldom any little knives had ever been brought before. They were of such a razor sharpness that a man might have shaved with them were his beard never so tough. But they required great care in their use, for even a moment of absent-mindedness or unsteadiness was sure to bring about an annoying injury. They had acquired an edge, a positively dangerous one, these little knives. One had the feeling that one only needed to come near the blade with a fingertip for the blood to gush out. Were these all the preparations? By no means. There was a precious wine from the port, sweet, fiery Cyprian wine, a dessert wine to be served with the oranges. The charming cups of hammered gold and glazed and painted earthenware stood ready, and at a sign from the hostess were handed round in the fountain court and the pillared hall by dainty little maids who had nothing on but bright-colored sashes. But who should pour this island wine into the cups? The little maids? No, the hostess had decreed that too little honor would thus be paid to her entertainment and her guests. She had arranged something else. She beckoned again, and the golden apples, the exquisite little knives, were passed. Both elicited cries of rapture. They praised the fruit. They praised the dainty tools. That is, they praised their daintiness, for with their chief property they were as yet unacquainted. They all set to at once to lay bare the sweet pulp. But soon their eyes were distracted from the task. Again Mutim Enet had beckoned, and he who now appeared on the scene was the cup-bearer, the pourer of the wine. It was Joseph. Yes, the lovesick woman had commanded him to this service, requesting, as his mistress, that he should himself serve the wine of Cyprus to her guests. She did not tell him of her other preparations. He did not know for what purpose of edification he was being used. It pained her, as we know, to deceive him, and deliberately make such misuse of his appearance, but her heart was set on enlightening her friends and laying bare her feelings. So she said to him, just after he had once more, with all possible forbearance, refused to lie with her, "Will you then, O Sarsif, at least do me a favor, and pour out the famous Alatian wine at my lady's party day after tomorrow, in token of its excelling goodness, also in token that you love me a little, and lastly to show that I am, after all, somebody in this house, since he at its head serves me and my guests?" "By all means, my mistress," he had answered. "That will I gladly do, and with the greatest pleasure, if it be one to you. For I am with body and soul at your command in every respect, save that I sin with you." So then Rachel's son, the young steward of Petipre, appeared suddenly among the ladies as they sat peeling in the court, in a fine white festal garment, with a colored Mycenaean jug in his hands. He bowed and began to move about, filling the cups. But all the ladies, those who had chanced to see him before, as well as those who did not know him, forgot at the sight not only what they were doing, but themselves as well, being lost in gazing at the cup-bearer. Then those wicked little knives accomplished their purpose, and the ladies, all and sundry, cut their fingers frightfully, without even being aware at the time, for a cut from such an exceedingly sharp blade is hardly perceptible, certainly not in the distracted state of mind in which Aene's friends then were. This oft-described scene has, by some, been thought to be apocryphal, and not belonging to the story as it happened. But they are wrong, for it is the truth, and all the probabilities speak for it. We must remember, on the one hand, that this was the most beautiful youth of his time and sphere. On the other, that these were the sharpest little knives the world has ever seen, and we shall understand that the thing could not happen otherwise, I mean with less shedding of blood, than as it actually did. Aene's dreamlike certainty of the event and its course was entirely justified. She sat there with her suffering air, her brooding, sinister, mask-like face and sinuous mouth, and looked at the mischief she had worked. The bloodbath, which at first no one saw but herself, for all the ladies were gaping in self-forgotten ardor after the youth as he slowly disappeared toward the pillared hall, where, Mut knew, the scene would repeat itself. Only when the beloved form had disappeared did she inquire of the ensuing stillness, in a voice of malicious concern, "My loves, whatever has happened to you all? What are you doing? Your blood is flowing." It was a fearful sight. With some, the nimble knife had gone an inch deep in the flesh, and the blood did not ooze, it spouted. The little hands, the golden apples, were drenched with the red liquid. It dyed the fresh whiteness of the linen garments, and soaked through into the women's laps, making pools which dripped down on the floor and their little feet. What an outcry, what wails, what shrieking arose when Moot's hypocritical concern made them aware what had happened. Some of them could not bear the sight of blood, especially their own. They threatened to faint, and had to be restored with oil of wormwood and other pungent little phials brought by the bustling maids. All the needful things were done. The neat little maids dashed about with cloths and basins, vinegar, lint, and linen bandages, until the party looked more like a hospital ward than anything else, in the pillared hall as well, whither Mut'im Enet went for a moment to assure herself that blood was flowing there too. Renanutet, the wife of the overseer of bulls, was among the more seriously wounded. They had to quench the flow of blood by putting a tourniquet on the wrists to shut off the circulation from the slowly paling and yellowing little hand. Likewise, Nesbamet, Beknekens's deep-voiced consort, had done herself considerable damage. They had to take off her outer garment, and she was tended and reassured by two of the girted maids, one black and one white, while she raved and raged in a loud voice at everybody indiscriminately. "Dearest head mother, and all of you, my dear friends," said the hypocrite Moot, when order had somewhat been restored, "how could it happen that here in my house you have done this to yourselves, and this red episode has marred my party? To your hostess, it is almost intolerable that it had to be in my house that it happened. How is such a thing possible? One person, or even two, might cut their fingers while peeling an orange, but all of you at once, and some of you to the bone. Such a thing has never happened before in the world, and will probably be unique in the social life of the two lands. At least let us hope so. But comfort me, my sweethearts, and tell me however it could happen." "Never mind," Nesbamet answered in her deep bass for the rest of the women. "Do not think of it, Enty, for everything is right now, at least nearly, even though red set has spoilt our afternoon frocks, and some of us are pale with bloodletting. Do not be upset, for your intentions were good, and as for the party, it is exclusive in every respect. Yet after all, it was pretty thoughtless of you, the thing you did in the middle of it. I am speaking quite frankly, and for all of us. Put yourself in our place. You invited us to explain the cause of your exhaustion, which mocks the best skill of the physicians. We must wait for the revelation, and that makes us nervous, so that we hide our suspense by making conversation. As you see, I am telling everything as it was, according to the simple truth, speaking for us all and not mincing matters. You served us with golden apples. Very good. Very fine, even. Pharaoh himself does not have them every day. But just as we are peeling them, there comes, by your order, this young cup-bearer into our already excited group. Whoever he is, I suppose that he is your young steward known on the land and the waterways as Nefer-Nefru. And it is mortifying for a lady to have to agree with the people of the dams and the canals, and with their judgment and tastes. But really, there can be no question of disagreeing with them, for he is certainly a picture of a young man from head to foot. In and for itself, it is something of a shock when a young man suddenly comes among a group of already nervous women, even if he is less attractive than this one. So what could you expect but that we should tremble in all our limbs and have tears come in our eyes when such a young god appears on the scene and bends with his jug over our cups? You could not expect us to attend to what we were doing and take care not to cut our fingers? We have caused you much bustle and annoyance with this bloodletting, but the blame, dearest Aene, with the lovely voice, is your own, for the trouble ensuing on your startling entertainment." "Yes, yes," cried Renanutet, wife of the overseer of bulls. "You must take the blame, my dear, for you have played us a fine trick, and we shall all remember it, though not with anger, since we realize that you could not be affected by it, and hence thought nothing of it. But that is just it, my treasure, that you failed in tact and consideration, and so to yourself is due in all justice the awkwardness of this red episode. For naturally the total femininity of this whole gathering affects each single female in it, and heightens her susceptibility to the uttermost. And then you elected to introduce a young man among us. And at what moment? Precisely when we were peeling our oranges. How could we help cutting ourselves? For it has to be just this cup-bearer who comes in. Your young steward. A perfect young Adonis. I must say frankly that I was beside myself at the sight. I speak without shame, for this is an hour, and these are circumstances when the mouth speaks from the fullness of the heart, and for once it seems quite right to say just what one thinks. I am a woman with a great deal of feeling for the masculine. You all know that besides my husband, the director of bulls, who is in his best years, I know a certain young officer of the guard. And also there is a young priest of the temple of Khonsu who comes to my house. You all know these things without my telling you, but all that does not prevent me from being always on the alert, so to speak, for the masculine. It is easy for me to feel perfectly divine, but I have a special weakness for cup-bearers. There is always something of the god, or a darling of the gods, about a cup-bearer. I do not know what that is. Probably it is because of his office and his motions. But this Refertem, this blue lotus, this honey youth with his jug? Ye gods, it was all up with me. I quite thought that I was seeing a god, and for sheer delight I did not know where I was. I was all eyes, and while I gazed, I stabbed myself with the fruit knife deep into my flesh, and the blood ran in streams, and I never felt it in the state I was in. But that is not the whole of it, for now, whenever I want to peel fruit in the future, I am convinced that the image of your divine young cupbearer will come up before me, the wretch, and I shall cut myself to the bone for losing myself in the sight of him, and can never eat any more fruit that must be peeled, though I am passionately fond of it. And all that you brought about, my treasure, with your heedlessness. Yes, yes, all the ladies echoed her, the ones who had been in the pillared hall as well, for they had come out to the court while Nesbamet and Renanutet were speaking. Yes, yes, they cried all together, in voices some shrill and some deep. The speakers have spoken as it was. We all nearly killed ourselves in our amazement at sight of this cupbearer, and instead of telling us the cause of your illness, to which end we were invited, Aeny, you have played us this trick. But now Mutem Ennet raised her voice to its full singing power, and cried, "Fools! I have not only told but showed it to you, the cause of my mortal weakness and all my misery. Then have some eye for me, as you were all eyes for him. You have seen him but the space of a few heartbeats, and done yourselves harm in your distraction, so that you are all pale with the red distress the sight of him gave you. But I must, or I may, see him every day. And what can I do in my own distress, which is unending and infinite? I ask you, where shall I turn? For this boy, you blind creatures who saw him in vain, the steward and cupbearer to my husband, he is my anguish and my death. He has brought me to my end with his eyes and mouth. For him alone, my sisters, my red blood gushes out in agony, and I die if he quench it not. For you only cut your fingers at sight of him, but love for his beauty has cut me to the heart, and I bleed to death." Thus she chanted, till her voice failed, and she fell back in her seat with convulsive sobs. We can imagine the state of high feminine excitement into which this revelation flung the troop of Moot's friends. They behaved as Tabubu and Mek and Waiset had done before them, in face of the great news that Moot had fallen in love. They treated the sufferer much as the other two had done, crowded round her, stroked and patted, congratulated, commiserated, in many-voiced, high-strung prattle. But the looks which they exchanged, the words which they murmured to each other, had quite another meaning than sympathy. They were angry and disappointed that there was no more to it, and that all this pretentious affliction amounted to no more than falling in love with a servant. There was silent disapproval and universal jealousy on the youth's account. But more than all, there was a certain dog-in-the-manger satisfaction that this was Moot, the proud and pure, the moon-chaste bride of Amun, who had been visited, so to speak, in her old age, and afflicted in quite the most ordinary way, that she was pining for a handsome slave, and did not even know how to keep it to herself, but must helplessly expose her humiliation like a regular female, wailing, "What shall I do?" That pleased her friends, if also it did not escape them that all the self-exposure and publicity were at bottom the same old conceit, which made of the most ordinary occurrence, when it was Moot to whom it happened, an extraordinary and world-shaking event. And that annoyed them afresh. But if all this spoke in the side glances which the ladies exchanged, yet their animation and pleasure in the sensation and the charming scandal in high life was sufficient to make them capable of heartfelt sympathy with their sister in distress, and of feminine solidarity. They crowded round her, embraced and petted her, and prattled loudly, expressing their views of the youth's good fortune in having been granted to rouse such feelings in the breast of his mistress. "Yes, sweet Aeny," they cried, "you have shown us, and we understand that it is no small thing for a woman's heart to have to be able to see such a picture of a young god every day. No wonder that in the end you too fell victim. The lucky fellow! What no man has succeeded in during all these years has fallen to his youth. He has actually stirred your senses. Certainly he was not born to it, but that shows the simplicity of the heart, which asks not after rank or station. He is no son of a gnome prince, and neither officer nor counselor of state, being only your husband's steward, but yet he has melted your heart, and that shall serve him for title. And that he is a foreigner, an Asiatic youth, and so-called Hebrew, makes the affair still more piquant, and gives it a cachet. Dearest, we are so glad and relieved that your distress and weariness has no worse cause than your feeling for this beautiful youth. You will forgive us if we cease to feel anxiety for you, and begin to feel it for him, for certainly the only ground here for fear is lest he may go out of his head with the honor done him. Otherwise the business seems to us quite simple. Ah, sobbed Moot, if you only knew, but you know nothing, and I knew that you would not, even after I opened your eyes, for you have no notion how it stands with him, or with the jealousy of the god to whom he belongs, and whose wreath he wears, so that he is much too good to stanch the blood of an Egyptian woman, and his soul has no ear for all my crying. Ah, how much better you would do, my sisters, not to be anxious for his great honor, but to devote all your concern to me, who am at death's door with his religious compunctions. Then her friends insisted on learning more particulars about these religious compunctions. They could not believe their ears when they heard that this servant was not bursting with pride at the honor done him, but was denying himself to his mistress. The looks they then exchanged did betray some malice, some suggestion that, after all, their Annie was too old for the beautiful youth, and he simply made pious excuses because he felt no desire. Some of them flattered themselves that they would be in better case with him, but in general they were sincerely indignant at the foreign slave's recalcitrance. Particularly Nesbamet, the head priestess, took the word in her bass voice and declared that from this point of view the affair was scandalous, and indeed not to be borne. "As a woman, dearest," said she, "I am on your side. Your affliction is mine. But there is a political aspect to the thing, too. It touches the state and the temple. And this little upstart—you will pardon me, I know you love him, but I call him so out of honest scorn—in his obstinate refusal to pay you the tribute of his youth, displays an insubordination dangerous to the kingdom. It is as though some Baal city of the Retenu or Phoenicia were to set himself up against Amun and refuse the duties which it owed. In that case, there would be a punitive expedition fitted out to protect the honor of Amun, even if it cost more than the tribute came to. In this light, my dear, I view your affliction, and as soon as I get home, I will speak with my husband, who is the head of all the priests of Upper and Lower Egypt, to tell him of this gross case of Canaanitish insubordination, and ask him what measures he thinks proper to deal with the disorder." She reached her conclusion amid more and even more animated chatter from all the guests, and thus the ladies' party at last broke up, which has become so famous and is here related in the true and actual course of its events. By it, Moot M. Ennett principally succeeded in making her unhappy passion the talk of the town, a success at which she herself, in her clearer moments, was probably horrified, yet, at other times, was capable, thanks to her increasing degeneration, of thinking of with a drunken satisfaction. For most infatuated people cannot believe that sufficient honor is shown their feelings unless they occupy the thoughts of all the world, if only to be mocked at and scorned. They must be known to the sparrows on the housetops. Her friends now often made her sick-bed visits, singly or by twos and threes, to inquire after her state, to comfort her, and give her advice. They foolishly passed over the actual, though entirely peculiar, circumstances, and the sufferer could only shrug her shoulders and reply, "Ah, my children, you chatter and advise and understand nothing at all of this peculiar case." Then the ladies of Waysay would be annoyed afresh, saying to each other, "If she thinks the matter is above our heads, and there is something quite peculiar about it, beyond any good counsel of ours, then she should hold her tongue and not tell us about the affair." But someone else came in person, born to Petipre's house between vanguard and rearguard, the great Beknekons, Amun's first, whose wife had informed him of the story, and who was not yet minded to take it lightly, but rather to see it in view of the larger interests involved. The mighty, shiny-pate and statesman of the church, wearing his arrogated leopard skin, strode to and fro before her lion-footed chair, straining upward from his ribs and holding his chin in the air as he declared that all personal and merely moral considerations must be put aside in judging this situation. This might be regrettable on the ground of standards of conduct and the moral order, but once begun, must be pursued to the end in the light of loftier considerations. As a priest, a spiritual guide, and guardian of religious order, and not least as the friend and colleague of the good Petitpré at court, he was obliged to censure the attentions Moot dedicated to this young man, and oppose the desire he aroused in her. But the recalcitrant bearing of this foreigner, his refusal to pay tribute, was intolerable to the temple, which would be obliged to insist that the matter be set right without delay, and to the glory of Amun. Therefore he, Becknekons, quite without regard to what might be personally desirable or blameworthy, must warn and admonish his daughter Moot to exert all her powers to the utmost to bring the rebellious youth to a fall, not for her own satisfaction, even though that might come to pass without his approval, but for that of the temple. If necessary, the backward youth could be brought to book by force. It shows with depressing clarity how low Moot had sunk, that this spiritual admonishment and authorization to sin did her soul good, that she could see in it a strengthening of her position with regard to the beloved one. To this she had come, the woman who but late and conformably with her stage of development had made her joy and sorrow dependent upon the freedom of his living soul, that now she found a desperate and distorted pleasure in the thought of having the object of her hot desire produced by force before the temple authorities. Yes, she was ripe for Tabubu's magic. But the position of the Amun authorities was not unknown to Joseph either, for no crack or cranny was too small for his faithful Besemheb to crawl into, that he might be present at the interview between Moot Emenet and Becknekons the Great, hear the advice with dwarf fine hearing, and bring it hot and hot to his patron and protégé. Joseph listened, and was extraordinarily strengthened in his view that this was a trial of strength between the power of Amun and God the Lord, and that he might not let him down at any price whatsoever, no matter how ill the resolve might accord with the old Adam in him.